Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 15th of May, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 65, and the title is Leaping Through the Horns of the Bull. What I'd like to do in this briefing is to reiterate for you the specific parameters of the upcoming stall. We are now entering a stall of the lunar apogee. And it so happens that the stall begins at the very moment that the lunar apogee has passed from that area in the sky, defining the horn tips of the bull, across the Milky Way to the area of stars defining the feet of the twins. So actually, when you look up at the sky, which you can't do right now because the sun is in the region to which I'm referring, it's too close to these constellations for you to view them. But at other times of the year, when you can look up to the bull and the twins, you'll see that the Milky Way, which is the edge of the third galactic arm in which the solar system is embedded, passes between the horn tips of the bull and the feet of the twins. So the twins are actually standing, as it were, in the Milky Way, about ankle deep or shin deep in the Milky Way. And the horns of the bull, or at least the southern horn tip, Sharatan, extends very close to the border of the Milky Way. Remember, the Milky Way is not the edge of the entire galaxy. We cannot see the entire galaxy. In fact, we only see about 3% of the stars that are in the galaxy. And we only see those stars which are in the immediate area of the third galactic arm. So what is called the Milky Way and has been also called galactos, from the Greek word galactos meaning milk, is only a small part of the entire galaxy. And it is the concentrated edge of the third limb as viewed from within that limb. So we're now living in the dramatic moment, which I've called the Gnostic moment, when the lunar apogee passes into the twins, and doing so, it touches a region in space which is also marked by an important location, and that is to say the perihelion of the planet Saturn, which is located about 92 degrees of the ecliptic, or 2 degrees of the sign Cancer. And that exactly is where the lunar apogee now stands. And so not only do we have the dramatic phase-over from bull to twins, leading into the third great lesson of the initialization of correction, but we have the element of Saturn involved here. And I'll talk more about that as time goes by. But as you know, the perihelion of Saturn, or the apsides of Saturn, consisting of the point closest to the sun and the point most distant from the sun, can be identified with the Magian order and the Gnostic movement. So when I speak in Starbase, and when I speak in the naked eye mythology of this practice about the planetary perihelia, I am speaking about great impulses that work themselves out over long periods of time. And as a matter of fact, you can use these perihelia to track historical events and trends, as it were, in the larger or large-scale evolutionary narrative of this planet. And that is a fascinating study. I believe that you could attribute the initial definition of that study to the famous astrologer and Renaissance man, Dane Rudjar, Dane Rudjar, who wrote The Astrology of Personality in 1945, virtually single-handedly brought astrology into the 20th century. Rudjar virtually modernized astrology and transformed it into a legitimate branch of psychology. Rudjar was also interested in these long-term developments. He wrote a book about them called The Sun is Also a Star. And he introduced the term eonics, interestingly enough. E-O-N-I-C-S. Of course, eon is a variation of the word aeon. Eon means a long period of time. The perihelia, or apsides, of the planets shift through the constellations over long periods of time. They are therefore aeonic markers, or eonic markers, excuse me. You should pronounce it eonic, of course. When we're not referring to the pleromic aeons, we're simply referring to these long time periods. And Rudjar introduced the term eonics for the study of these large-scale time periods, and I've devoted an enormous amount of time to that, and there are piles of notebooks in my archives at Ambergain House containing the research that I accumulated in my studies of eonics. So the word eonic in this context might cause you to recall another word that I used upon sending out the invitation to the Gaian navigation experiment. That's a term I took from Joseph Campbell's Creative Mythology, and that term would be mythogenetic. You know, Campbell spoke of the mythogenetic moment. He spoke particularly of the 13th century in European culture. The 13th century was the time of the appearance of Parzival by Wolfram von Eschenbach and other versions of the Parzival legend, such as the one of Chrétien de Troyes, various other writers of the period, as well as the time of the epic romance Tristan and Isolde by Gottfried of Strasbourg. And it was a remarkable moment, the 13th century, remarkable moment and turning point in human history. And Campbell called it a mythogenetic moment because he deemed that the power of the myth-making imagination of humanity achieved a certain optimal expression at that moment, and indeed it did. The mere production, if it were only that, the mere production of those two works of literature would be enough to mark that moment as exceptional, and that there was much, much more that occurred throughout the 12th and into the 13th century. For instance, the movement of the troubadours, the rise of the romantic movement, the definition of romance, of love, the cult of amour, all of these things represent these cultural phenomena represented at that time an explosive expression of human creativity. So Joseph Campbell deemed that such a powerful moment might again recur at the threshold of the 21st century. In fact, that was, in a way, the essence of the message of his book, Creative Mythology, which is the fourth volume of In the Masks of God series. And those four volumes are, of course, masterworks of comparative mythology. There's really nothing quite like them. You may know, if you've read metahistory.org, that there is an entire section called an Alternative History of the Grail on that site. And I refer extensively to Campbell in that series of 10 essays, I think. It's an incomplete section, but there are 10 essays. And First one is called Grail Magic Versus, The Paternal Lie. So, of course, that series of writings on metahistory treats extensively of the Grail legend using the version of Wolfram von Eschenbach. And somewhere in those writings, I point out that Campbell looked very closely at the events of the 12th century when Wolfram wrote Parzival. The German spelling is P-A-R-Z-I-V-A-L, and the French spelling is P-A-R-S-I-F-A-L, Parzival, a softer pronunciation. Anyway, Campbell noted very closely that, and I believe this is true, that certain events of the 13th century had certainly not gone unnoticed by Wolfram and other Romantics and pagans of the day. And it so happens that at the very moment that these two masterworks of European literature were produced, Parzival and Tristan and Isolde, the Roman Catholic Church attempted to pull off one of the greatest scams in its long history of scamming the human race into depravity and enslavement. And that scam was pronounced in the year 1240, I believe, at what is called the Fourth Lateran Council. Joseph Campbell writes specifically about this. Go read Creative Mythology. It's well worth reading. It has lots of long digressions in it, but he gets to the point. The Fourth Lateran Council, 1240 AD, I believe. Well, what was the big deal about that? Well, that was when the monstrous fiends at the head of the Roman Catholic Church decided that they would declare upon the world a very evil spell. And I consider what the representatives of the church did at that time to have been flatly equivalent to a deed of black magic, if you will, a deed of very evil black magic perpetrated upon the human race and perpetrated against the Anthropos and against the Sophianic vision of life. And what was that deed? It was the assertion of the dogma of transubstantiation. According to the dogma of transubstantiation, established at the Fourth Lateran Council, the giving of Mass with the ritual of bread and wine constituted a real act in which those ritual objects of consumption were to be taken literally as the blood and body of Christ. And this action, this dogma, you may wonder, what could such the pronouncement of such a dogma actually do to the world? What could it actually do to the human imagination? Well, I assure you, it could do a lot of damage, and did do a lot of damage. And Campbell, certainly would have agreed with that, because he makes a straightforward equation between the black magician, so-called, the evil magician, is a better word, Klingsor, in the Grail legend of Wolfram von Parzival, with Pope Innocent III, and in effect says that Wolfram had was basing the figure of the evil magician on this historical figure. Well, I would say that I agree wholly with Joseph Campbell, not only about his interpretations of things that happened in the 12th century, 13th century, but also with his assertion that we are back at a mythogenetic moment at the dawn of the 21st century. Of course, you know that I can say, with my predictable grandiosity and self-importance, that I consider the Gaia navigation experiment and the declaration of Sophia's correction to be the greatest event so far in this current mythogenetic moment. Of course I do. I consider the GNE and participation in the correction of Sophia to be the highest challenge of the imagination of the human species right here, right now. And again, I see a parallel which Campbell also saw or anticipated, because he didn't live into the 21st century. I think he died in 1986. But the parallel that I see is that just at the same, in the same way that the Roman Catholic Church attempted to put an evil spell on human imagination at a moment when the human imagination was bursting forth with the Grail legend and the mystery of the organic light, and bursting forth with the fantastic romantic psychology of Tristan and Isolde, at that very moment, the enemies of humanity attempted to lay an evil spell down across the planet that would repress and cover up these fantastic productions of human genius. And the same thing is happening right now. I have no doubt that the human species is, at this moment, in one of those great crises of mythogenesis of which Campbell spoke and which he articulated so brilliantly in Creative Mythology. And for you and I in the GNE, well, we're a privileged bunch of kids, I can tell you that, aren't we? We have the opportunity not only to conceptualize all this, to take it on board intellectually, to take it on board empathically, to be passionate about it, to know that your life depends on it, to know that you're not going to have a life worth living on this planet unless the Anthropos can recover from these evil spells. No one will have a life worth living. Knowing all that, we have the enormous privilege of being able to look up into the sky and cast our eyes upon these magnificent constellations and read the fate of our species therein. I've said before that there are three great lessons to be learned in the course of the 3 years of initialization. And they are connected with the three constellations through which the lunar apogee progresses during that time. So you understand the method here. You understand that when the navigator speaks of these things, I don't speak in the abstract, do I? I'm not giving you metaphysical principles, am I? I'm not just talking to you about what I might intuit as some kind of dawning truth. I'm not feeding you speculation. I am following along with you the palpable evidence of how human imagination works at the interface with the supernatural powers that produce this world and this living dream that you inhabit. And we verify what we imagine by what we observe in this experiment, in this GNE. Verify what you imagine by what you can observe. Show me someone else who uses this method. We're extremely privileged to be able to operate in this way. And right now, we in this experiment are verifying a leap through the horns of the bull into the twins. And we observe the action of the lunar apogee in order to know the exact timing in which this occurs. So let me give you the timing of the stall. Officially, we can say it began on May 13th. That was just 2 days ago. At that point, at that moment, there was an apogee surge in 2 degrees of Cancer, which is 92 degrees of the ecliptic. Remember how we use the ecliptic and sign notations to locate a specific point in the constellations. And that point, right at the feet of the twins, right in the twinkly toes of Castor and Pollux, corresponds also to the perihelion of the planet Saturn. So the stall begins 2 days ago, officially, and at that time Jupiter is lagging behind the lunar apogee by about 12 degrees. It would be in 20 Gemini, placing it between the horns of the bull, further down, back toward the forehead of the bull. Jump to the next event of significance, which is May 28th. If you're lucky and if you have a low horizon to the west, you may see, visible for a short period of time, Venus and Jupiter conjunct near the star Charatan, marking the southern horn tip of the bull. And also, although you won't be able to see it with the naked eye, that is in very close proximity to the Crab Nebula. And it so happens that Mercury will also be conjoined with Venus and Jupiter. So that Venus-Jupiter conjunction in the horn tips of the bull, as you recall, would be a repetition of the date of Venus and Jupiter at the Pleiades, which occurred in March of 2012. At that moment, we celebrated the return of the Seven Sisters to the chamber of the Pleiades. We celebrated the recognition of the Hetaira and of the union of Venus and Jupiter, the pleasure of guidance and the guidance of pleasure. So at the end of May, there is a kind of reiteration of that whole experience. Then we move into June. On the 9th of June, there is a lunar apogee surge, again in 2 Cancer. The apogee is stalled exactly at that point. But at this time, Jupiter has moved ahead now, and is within, say, 5 degrees of the moon at that moment. Coming ahead to July 7th, the lunar apogee has dropped back 1 degree. It's at 1 Cancer, and Jupiter at that moment, July 7th, reaches the twins and passes from the bull into the twins. And so we have the Jupiter-lunar apogee converge around July 7th of this year. Moving ahead to August, the lunar apogee is still in the stall, but the stall begins to break in August, and Jupiter, in its turn, moves ahead of the lunar apogee, so it's located about 7 degrees deep, more deeply into the twins. Finally, when we come to the end of August, the lunar apogee has moved out of the stall. It has reached 7 Cancer, 97 of the ecliptic, which is sort of in the knees of the twins. And Jupiter is ahead of it by about 7 degrees. And they will perform another converge in November, because Jupiter is going to slow down and go into its retrograde phase. And as you can see, we have once again that magnificent tango of the lunar apogee with Jupiter, which marks the whole process of correction. It defines the process of correction. And we see that happening again this year. So the duration of the stall is from about the middle of May to the middle of August. That is 3 complete months. And we're going into the stall right now at this time. So I thought it would be appropriate to look back a little bit at the image of the bull, draw from that immense and rich stellar composite, reflect a little on the lessons it contains reflect on some of the themes and allusions that are carried in that celestial archetype, if you will. And that will give me an opportunity to review some of the things I've said about the bull, to add a little bit of new material, and in a way to sum up the process that has brought us to this point. I was looking at images on the internet from the Minoan civilization. And as you may know, one of the sports celebrated by the Minoans of Crete was bull leaping. Lithe young men and women would actually leap across the backs of bulls and leap between their horns. And there are magnificent Minoan frescoes that depict this exotic sport. I can really relate to that image right now, and I think you can too, because we in the GNE are in effect doing exactly that, leaping across the horns of the bull into the twins. And this is a leap of imagination. It's a leap of courage. It's a leap of beauty. But it's not a leap of faith, because faith is not involved in this process, unless it be the faith in your own mind and faith in your capacity as a human animal to realize the divine endowment of the anthropos. Yes, faith in the anthropos, if you will, but not faith in any kind of conventional sense of religion. I think if I had to refer to that expression at all, that expression, leap of faith, does come to mind, I would spin it a little, and I would call it rather a leap of fate, you know? I mean, one of the grandiose implications of the GNE and planetary tantra in general is to change the fate of the human species, to change the fate of humanity, to orchestrate the fate of humanity. I mean, talk about pretenses. And how would anyone even conceive such a thing? Well, you have to conceive such a thing. You have to play with that idea. If you are one of those human animals who chooses to stand against the deceit and manipulation that is rampant on this planet, no one can escape it. And it is so pervasive that it has actually become the fate of humanity. So it's not surprising that you hear people talk about the slave species concept. And it's not surprising that people buy the Sitchin scenario. And it's not surprising that they go around thinking that the Archons hacked into the human genome and that we're all programmed to be slaves, and that the global banking mafia led by the Rothschilds is running on a reptilian agenda to enslave the whole human race. It's not surprising that the human imagination thrashes around wildly with those kind of scenarios, because it is certain that something is terribly wrong with the way human beings live together in communities and in nations. And something is terribly wrong with those human animals who are in a position of dominance and influence. And so if you don't like that, and if you don't want to go along with it, and if you'd even like to find some way to resist it and overcome it, then you must consider the possibility of changing the fate of the whole human species, one person at a time. Remember that wonderful saying comes from Kundry, fate of the kalpa turns upon one life at a time. And so, who decides the fate of humanity? Well, I do, if I choose to, and so do you. And that is a position to take. That is the position or action of the great leap. It's a position you take. I choose to change the fate of humanity because I refuse to submit to its current state of confusion and degeneration. I refuse to be part of its degeneration. Therefore, I choose to change the fate of humanity. And the only way to do that, that I know of, at the level that could really make a difference, a massive permanent difference, is to use the power of the sacred narrative combined with magic. Now, you know that planetary tantra is defined as interactive magic with Gaia, say interactive magic with the Aeon Sophia. It's the same thing. The Shakti cluster is a toolkit for interactive magic with the Earth, isn't it? And you have only just begun, as have I, to see how that toolkit works. We're just beginners. We're in the kindergarten of planetary tantra. But one thing that I can assure you, that if you are going to be like me, and that is to say, grandiose enough and arrogant enough in the Gnostic sense to leap to the challenge and change the fate of humanity, then you better understand that you need magic to do that. And that magic and morality go together. So it's not just about finding the guts to take a moral stand in any particular situation that life may present to you, where the corruption and deception of this world comes at you. It's not just a matter of that moral and existential commitment, but it's a matter of combining that with an understanding of the supernatural, learning how to handle the supernatural, how to handle it, and thereby combining the genuine power of magic with your moral autonomy as a human animal. That is to say, with your conscience. The power of conscience and the capacity for magic in the human animal are deeply and intimately related. And so far in the GNE, we've had many, many lessons, haven't we? We've had many, many lessons through the epoch of the ram and the satanic face of Cetus. Many, many lessons through the period of the bull. And now, in the third and final phase of this experiment, come the lessons of Idris, which are lessons about fate and the ability to orchestrate fate. Now, I use those terms, you know. They're just words. They're grandiose words. And I could easily be accused of delusions of grandiosity merely by speaking such words. And I can tell you that I don't even half know what those words mean. It's an inceptive syntax, my friends. Whenever I say you are involved in the orchestrations of fate extending to the realm of the aeons, that's an inceptive syntax. And it's up to you to find out, to explore and investigate what that syntax can do. When I say you are involved in orchestrations of the fate of the Anthropos to meet the designs and purposes of the Aeon Sophia, it's a proposition that the Nawal places in your mind. That links you dynamically into the Nahual of your mind. And so this potential, as it's loosely called, has been seeded in us already, seeded in our imaginations through these preceding 20 months or 22 months in this GNE. And the seeding operates through the syntax. I don't know what you think, but in my view, this experiment has acquired enormous momentum through the lessons drawn from the stellar constellation of the Bull. Not the least of these, of course, is the lesson about the AC and DC currents. I mean, I did not know myself until maybe a month or a month and a half ago what were the masculine and feminine polarities of divine imagination. I couldn't have defined them in the way that I can now. I couldn't have related them or associated them with their biological expressions in the natural world in the way that I can now. So, this is the way the process works. This is the way the experiment works. It's an adventure in higher learning, if you want to call it that. Now, before I proceed with some more reflections about the Bull, the constellation of the Bull and its connotations and archetypal and historical ramifications, I'd like to make one correction regarding the matter of the Christic intercession I spoke of in NAB Briefing 64, you may remember. And I like to be as precise as I can be, of course, when I talk about certain details of the sacred narrative. And I'd like you to know as well that I'd like you to know the basis upon which I am developing the narrative, of course. You are intimately involved in this process with me, and so I'd like you to know where I'm coming from. Now, I said mistakenly that the only place we find an account of the Christic intercession is in the paraphrase of the adversaries of the Gnostics, the so-called church fathers like Irenaeus, who came out to protest the teachings of the heretics. And I cited the relevant passage from against heresies by Irenaeus. But you recall that I also spoke of a document in the Nag Hammadi collection known as the Valentinian Exposition. Now I'm looking at a Valentinian Exposition right now. This is Nag Hammadi Codex number 11. It was found in the 11th book, and it's the second document in the book. I'm looking now at the scholar's edition on 5 volumes, the Coptic Gnostic Library, which is published by Brill in Leiden in the Netherlands. And this is the one that has the Coptic text on the left and the English translation on the right. And remember that I said that Valentinus' version of the Sophianic narrative contained some compromise elements not found in the Sethian version. I should point out, though, that there are a couple of lines in this damaged document that refer directly to the Christic intercession. So it's not true that it's only in Irenaeus. I believe it's in Irenaeus and perhaps uniquely in the Valentinian Exposition. See, I haven't gone back with a fine-tooth comb for the 58th time lately to rake through these documents. So it may well be that in the Agnostus or the Sophia of Jesus Christ, as it's translated, or some other cosmological document, that there is a line or two that specifically describes the intercession. Possibly, but I don't think so. I think the only line in the whole corpus is right here in a Valentinian Exposition, and it goes like this. It says, a perfect form ascended into. I'm going to read it to you in the fragmentary way that it's presents itself. A perfect form, perfect is telia, which uses the root telos, which is the root of the word telestes. Okay? Perfect form ascended into the pleroma. He did not want to consent to the suffering. Detained him by limit, that is, by the syzygy, since her correction will not occur through anyone except her own son, who alone is the fullness of divinity. He willed within himself bodily to leave the powers, and he descended. And these things, i.e. passions, Sophia suffered after her son ascended from her, she knew that she dwelt in a 8 lines missing. Indeed, Jesus and Sophia revealed the creature, since, after all, the seeds of Sophia are incomplete and formless. Jesus contrived a creature of this sort and made it of the seeds while Sophia worked with him. Okay, so there you go. By the way, what they translate as Jesus is not written as Jesus. You know, it's just written as 2 Coptic letters, I and S, with a line over them. It's written in code. Now, that could be also Iisus, Iisos, which means the healer, the one who heals. It doesn't necessarily translate directly into Jesus. In any case, it is clear from the larger framework that the aeon Christos is the particular aeon involved here. And you can see that the actual text, although it's very fragmentary, of a Valentinian Exposition describes both the descent of the aeon Christos and some type of cogeneration of the two. The upon the seeds of the Anthropos. So there you go. And also, it is always well to bear in mind that a Valentinian exposition contains one of the most outstanding lines in the whole Coptic material, which is this line. For it is the will of the Father, that is to say, the originator, who stands behind and at the source of all the aeons. For it is the will of the originator not to allow anything to happen in the Pleroma apart from a syzygy. End quote. Such an important line, you know. Because that is to say that the originator, who feeds pure and undefined singularities to the generators for them to elaborate into world systems, wishes that the generators operate in dyads or pairs or syzygies in the elaboration of these massive evolutionary and creative impulses, or impulses of emanationist dreaming of the gods. And one of the details of the sacred narrative of Sophia, which we return to again and again, tells us that she violated this rule. Because although the originator wishes that to be so, the originator doesn't force anything on the generators. And so when she dreamed, she co-generated the Anthropos with Thelete, consistent with the will of the originator, that nothing in the Pleroma should happen apart from a dyad, a coupling. But then when it came around to envisioning a world system, envisioning a divine experiment in which that Anthropos would unfold and test itself against its own potentials, that she dreamed entirely on her own. And that is, of course, one of the most important plot features in the cosmological narrative of the Divine Sophia. So there you have it. A rare instance when I will go back and stick my nose into those grubby old materials and pull out some lines for you. But I assure you that the 9-episode version, especially with the revision of Sophia and Thelete, is firmly grounded in the textual materials and faithfully follows the fragmentary evidence that we have of this most magnificent and incomparable story. So there you go. Back to the subject of the bull. You know, I've spoken in the past about the years in L.A. when I studied with the gentleman called Vili Sukar. He was the founder of the anthroposophical school of astrology known as astrosophy. And I learned many things working with Vili Sukar. And one thing that certain things really stick out in my mind after all those years, and I'm talking about going back to 1976 now, okay? Some things really stick out in my mind from Sukar's work. And one thing that I remember is that he pointed out that the constellation of the bull was associated with historical developments leading to the rise of communism and dialectical materialism. You get that? Now, that's an aeonic, excuse me, that's an eonic observation. That's an observation that you would make in the study of eonics. Long-term historical patterns reflected in planetary cycles against the background of the constellations. And so in making those kind of studies, Vilisukra had determined that the bull had this association. And I was really struck by that. It's connected with the rise of communism. And how true is that fact? Ha! Well, let me tell you this, my friends. There is a documentary on YouTube, and I dare you to watch it. If you have the guts to watch it, you're a courageous person. This is called Under the Sign of the Scorpion. It actually has two titles. The other title is In the Shadow of Hermes. And this is a documentary that comes from someone called Juri Lina, J-U-R-I-L-I-N-A, Lina being the last name. And I think he's Finnish or Norwegian. Now, this is a pretty reliable documentary, as far as I can tell. I don't think it contains disinformation. I think it's quite factual. And if you ever want to get a stomach full of the full extent of Jewish mass murder committed by the Bolsheviks, by which I do not mean the mass murder of Jews, but the mass murder committed by Jews and under the direction of Jews, who were up to the number of about 200, I think, the leading ideologues of the Bolshevik Revolution. If you want to ever get a gutful of what that was about and what it really looked like, then go watch this documentary by Juri Lina. And it describes the Jewish command structure of Bolshevik communism. And it names by name about 20 of the leading mass murderers of the Bolshevik party. And it shows in both documentary and dramatic or dramatized footage exactly what they did. And it shows the extent to which they did it, which is conservatively estimated at about 65 million over a number of decades. One of the really fascinating parts of Juri Lina's documentary is about the takeover of the Winter Palace on the evening of November 7th, 1917. You know, the Bolsheviks walked right into the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg and in one moment just walked in. The guards stood aside. He describes it all in absolutely vivid and exact detail how this happened. They walked in, and they walked in at 2:10 in the morning or something like that. And why did they go through the doors and into the heart of the Winter Palace and symbolically lay their hands upon the Russian Empire, a bunch of thugs, a bunch of genocidal psychopaths such as the world has never seen, with an agenda of racial and ethnic cleansing that makes your worst nightmare look like a ride in the park? Why did they go in at the moment they went in? And he explained that it was astrological, and that they had the intention to take over the Winter Palace at an exact moment astrologically calculated. And I believe that he's true. He's correct about that. And what do you find when you go look at that moment? November 7th, November 8th, 1917, well, you find Jupiter in the eye of the bull, exactly where it has been for the last 2 or 3 months. So there is some astrology, if you will. There is some historical / astrological research that strongly supports the notion that the Russian Revolution under the Jewish Bolshevik regime and the Marxist dialect and the rise of Marxist dialectical materialism can be associated with the bull, the constellation of the bull, and with events that occurred, planetary events that occurred in the bull. I would add to that that the remarkable fact that astrologers who have studied American history and who have, for instance, cast charts for the American Revolution of 1776 and so forth, have found, by contrast, that the distinguishing events, planetary events that signal the key events of the American Revolution, occur in the constellation of the twins. Now, I don't predict, and so I won't predict, but I will say that as the lunar apogee shifts into the twins and Jupiter itself shifts from the bull into the twins, that I wouldn't be surprised if there was a massive civil uprising in the United States in August of 2013. And whatever happens, one point remains eminently clear, that when the moment comes a little later in the summer, after the sun goes through the bull, it's entering the bull now, sun goes through the bull, sun goes through the twins, and then after that, they become visible. And when they become visible again, and you have that opportunity, wherever you are, to go out and stand and look up at the constellation of the bull, and then shift your eyes and look over the constellation of the twins, you can register in your mind that the momentous historical events of the fates of two nations are written in those constellations. And that is a verifiable fact. And I would venture to add to that that with it's no coincidence then that the initial conditions of correction would, in a sense, rewrite the conditions of those events. Can you see that? The cosmos would rewrite and overwrite the planetary conditions that signaled the Russian Revolution in the bull and the American Revolution in the twins, and also, to a certain extent, extending into the crab, during these 3 years of correction. Why? Because those two revolutions are the most significant historical events within recent memory which have to be understood in order for correction to work as a cultural and historical wake-up. Those are the lessons of history that cannot be repeated, but that in some way must be reenacted now, but at another level. Not reenacted in a blind theater of compulsion and manipulation and sleepwalking, but to be reenacted with eyes wide open. And I am certain that it will prove to be true not too many years from now. If someone comes across these briefings, someone retraces the GNE or picks up the chronicles that you have left to others by your notes, by the things that you have written, that they will look upon our observations and realize that our observations were profound, and that we looked to the very cosmic reflections of history. We looked into the cosmic reflections of history, and we didn't blink. And that's what I mean by leaping through the horns of the bull. One of the lessons that must have been learned from the bull, from that archetype, is that communism, Marxist communist ideology, which went into the Maoist communist ideology, is an instrument of central banking. There is no such thing as communism for the benefit of the masses. That is a total lie. The definition of communism as the ownership of the means of production by the working class is a complete lie. Do you know how much money Lenin had in his Swiss bank account when he died? Do you know how much money he left in his Swiss bank account? It was something like 25 million francs, Swiss francs, maybe 40 million. Communism, which is now taking over the United States through the creeping socialist platform of the current president, whose real father was probably a Marxist ideologue in Chicago. Communism is a tactic of centralization of wealth and power, disguised as a program of the distribution of wealth and power to the masses. In communist Russia, do you think that the wealth and power of the communist regime was distributed to the masses? And so those are perhaps the two horns of the bull, considered in one sense. They're the two horns of the same animal. One horn is central banking, and the other horn is communism. And they both belong to the same monstrous force, which is a narrative of human imagination that has the objective either to enslave the human race or to murder, torture, and eliminate that which cannot be enslaved. And when you see Trey Lina's documentary, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. The degree of murder and torture that was perpetrated under the Russian Jewish Bolshevik regime is truly mind-boggling and inconceivable. I won't call it unbelievable, because I totally believe it, because the evidence is there, but it's inconceivable that human animals could go to that length against other human animals. And they were just winding up. They were just winding themselves up for the final act. And the other thing that I would say to you, my friends, and I say this to give you courage to face the truth. Not only is communism Marxist, which is a Marxist Jewish ideology, an instrument of a central banking mafia on this planet, but both that central banking mafia the globalist banking mafia that profits from wars, and its instrument for social control, communism, both of those factors are expressions of the Zadok principle. You know, the baffling thing about Marxist communism and Zionism, in fact, is that it's atheistic. And this is very baffling because the record clearly shows that it was Posadzis, people of self-assigned Jewish identity, who produced this Marxist ideology of communism at the end of the 19th century, from the midpoint of the 19th century, from 1845 through and into the 20th century. And it is a clear and obvious fact, known to all who search into these materials, that the Jewish thinkers, such as Marx, who produced this ideology, were atheists. You know, Theodor Herzl, founder of International Zionist Movement, they were atheists. And so when you hear the term Jewish atheist, you think, wow, that sort of cuts those people off from, say, devout Jews or Talmudic Jews or, you know, people who are deeply religious. Talmudic Jews are deeply religious. And Marxist ideologues are atheists, and never the twain shall meet. And that is completely wrong. That is completely wrong. Because what you see in the ideology of dialectical materialism and Marxist communism is the ultimate social expression of the religious principle of the Zadoks, of the Zadokim. It is a non-religious implementation of a religious ideology, if you can get your mind around that. A non-religious implementation of a religious ideology, which I am calling the Zadok principle. And what is that? Well, it is simply the master race principle, which is enshrined in the teachings or in the belief system of the Old Testament, of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and of the Talmud. And so even though the Bolshevik ideologues of the Russian Revolution were irreligious, they were carrying out the final solution of a religious ideology that originates in the cult of the Zadokim. And I am more convinced today than I ever was that I really nailed them on that one. Because I don't see anybody being more precise and exact about the origin of this ideology. And so, what the world saw was the rise of Marxist communism, which today is trying to take over the United States through the creeping socialism is a creeping form of it, and now they're using very clever social control and mind control techniques following the program of Saul Alinsky. If you don't know anything about Saul Alinsky, go take a look at that. So they're using Saul Alinsky tactics in the United Kingdom and in the United States as a way to implement socialist programs that in turn feed into the greater scheme of communism, which is a scheme of the centralization of power in the hands of a very small elite number of people, as was the case with the Bolsheviks in Russia. And that is the ultimate goal of the Tzaddik principle expressed as a social ideology without any religious trappings. You know, at the end of the day, does it matter whether it's religious or not? It's the same program, just branded in two different ways. And so I would ask you, as I conclude this briefing, to bear in mind that of the many, many lessons that we have drawn from the constellation of the Bull, and they have been magnificent lessons regarding the sublime dimensions of the Sophianic vision story and the power of the goddess and the power of divine imagination and human imagination and all that is wonderful. But I would have you bear in mind that eonic studies clearly show that there must be a collision in history between the Sophianic narrative and those who live the Sophianic narrative and those who would carry out the Tzaddik principle, which is the most enslaving, deceitful, murderous, and destructive agenda of behavior on this planet. And we are living in the mythogenetic moment of that collision. I've said before, and I'll just give you this final clue, and this will give you a little thrill to go to sleep with. There was a woman in Paris. Her name was Francine Glinka. Okay? And she was a Russian living in Paris, as many Russian aristocrats did on the eve of the Russian Revolution. And she was, in some respects, a spy for the Tsarist regime. And this woman, Francine Glinka, a Russian immigrant living in Paris, was instrumental in that underground network that brought the Sophianic vision out of obscurity and back to the world through the back door of Russian intellectual and cultural circles, namely the symbolist movement, the Russian symbolist movement, headed by Andrei Bielik and Alexander Blok and other mystical poets, Tweetchev and others, whose godfather was Vladimir Soloviev. And so this Francine Glinka woman was part of the network connected closely with the Russian aristocratic family of the Trubetskoys, who actually brought the Sophianic teachings that had gone underground virtually in the 13th century, brought them out and began to propagate them through intellectual circles in Russia. And as I've said, there is some relationship between the fury of the Bolshevik Revolution, the murderous fury of the Bolshevik Revolution, and the emergence of the Sophianic vision of life in Russia at that very moment. Contemplate that, my friends. And while you're at it, contemplate this detail. That those who have looked into these matters credit Francine Glinka with having discovered and exposed a notorious document called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I don't know if Juri Lina mentions the protocols in his documentary, but you certainly know what they are. And Henry Ford certainly did. He gave a free copy of them to everyone who bought one of his cars. And when they said to him, "But Mr. Ford, it's been proven that these documents, which, as I say, were revealed by this woman, Francine Glinka, these documents are just a forgery and they're propaganda to make the world hate the Jews, you know, they're anti-Semitic propaganda. They're forgeries." And Henry Ford said, "Well, I don't know about that. All I can say is they fit what's happening." So with that juicy little anecdote, I will complete this briefing. And I wish you all a happy and healthy and vigorous leap as we take the GNE forward in time, in space, in dreaming and waking, with all the love for the goddess that we can handle. Take it in a great leap through the horns of the bull.